years she had slain every other woman sent against her, it was said.
All men must die, and women too, but not all will be remembered.
Danny had no answer for that.
If this is truly what my people wish, do I have the right to deny it to them? It was their city before it was mine, and it is their own lives they wish to squander. I will consider all you have said. Thank you for your counsel, she rose. We will resume on the morrow. Old Neil for Daenerys Stormborn, the Unburnt, Queen of Meereen, Queen of the Andals, and the Rhoynar, and the First Men, Khaleesi of Great Grass Sea, Breaker of Shackles, and Mother of Dragons,
Missandei called. Sir Barristan escorted her back up to her chambers.
Tell me a tale, sir,
Danny said as they climbed.
Some tale of valour with a happy ending.
She felt in need of happy endings.
Well, tell me how you escaped from the usurper.
Your Grace, there is no valour in running for your life. Danny seated herself on a cushion, crossed her legs, and gazed up at him.
Please. It was the young usurper who dismissed you from the Kingsguard.
Joffrey, aye. They gave my age for a reason, though the truth was elsewise. The boy wanted a white cloak for his dog, Sandor Clegane, and his mother wanted the Kingslayer to be her Lord Commander. When they told me, I took off my cloak, as they commanded, threw my sword at Joffrey's feet, and spoke unwisely.
What did you say?
The truth. But truth was never welcome at that court. I walked from the throne room with my head high, though I did not know where I was going. I had no home but White Sword Tower. My cousins would find a place for me at Harvest Hall, I knew, but I had no wish to bring Joffrey's displeasure down upon them. I was gathering my things when it came to me that I had brought this on myself by taking Robert's pardon. He was a good knight but a bad king, for he had no right to the throne he sat. That was when I knew that to redeem myself I must find the true king and serve him loyally with all the strength that still remained me.
My brother, Viserys.
Such was my intent. When I reached the stables, the gold cloaks tried to seize me. Joffrey had offered me a tower to die in, but I had spurned his gift. So now he meant to offer me a dungeon. The commander of the city watch himself confronted me, emboldened by my empty scabbard. But he had only 3 men with him, and I still had my knife. I slashed one man's face open when he laid his hands upon me and rode through the others. As I spurred for the gates, I heard Janus Slynt shouting for them to go after me. Once outside the Red Keep, the streets were congested, else I might have gotten away clean. Instead, they caught me at the river gate. The gold cloaks who had pursued me from the castle shouted for those at the gate to stop me. So they crossed their spears to bar my way.
And you without your sword, how did you get past them?
A true knight is worth 10 guardsmen. The men at the gate were taken by surprise. I rode one down, wrenched away his spear, and drove it through the throat of my closest pursuer. The other broke off once I was through the gate, so I spurred my horse to a gallop and rode hell-bent along the river until the city was lost to sight behind me. That night I traded my horse for a handful of pennies and some rags, and the next morning I joined the stream of small folk making their way to King's Landing. I'd gone out the Mudgate, so I returned through the Gate of the Gods, with dirt on my face, stubble on my cheeks, and no weapon but a wooden staff. In rough-spun clothes and mud-cake boots I was just one more old man fleeing the war. The gold cloaks took a stag from me and waved me through. King's Landing was crowded with small folk who'd come seeking refuge from the fighting. I lost myself amongst them. I had a little silver, but I needed that to pay my passage across the narrow sea. So I slept in septs and alleys, and took my meals in pot shops. I let my beard grow out and cloaked myself in age. The day Lord Stark lost his head, I was there, watching. Afterward I went into the great sept and thanked the seven gods that Joffrey had stripped me of my cloak.
The Stark was a traitor who met a traitor's end.
Your Grace, said Selmy, Eddard Stark played a part in your father's fall, but he bore you no ill will. When the eunuch Varys told us that you were with child, Robert wanted you killed, but Lord Stark spoke against it. Rather than countenance the murder of children, he told Robert to find himself another hand.
Have you forgotten Princess Rhaenys and Prince Aegon?
Never. That was Lannister work, Your Grace.
Lannister or Stark, what difference? Viserys used to call them the usurper's dogs. If a child is set upon by a pack of hounds, does it matter which one tears out his throat? All the dogs are just as guilty. The guilt.
The word caught in her throat. Hazael, she thought, and suddenly she heard herself say,
I have to see the pit, in a voice as small as a child's whisper. Take me down, sir, if you would.
A flicker of disapproval crossed the old man's face, but it was not his way to question his queen. As you command. The servant's steps were the quickest way down, not grand, but steep and straight and narrow, hidden in the walls. Sir Barristan brought a lantern, lest she fall. Bricks of 20 different colours pressed close around them, fading to grey and black beyond the lantern light. Thrice they passed unsullied guards, standing as if they had been carved from stone. The only sound was the soft scruff of their feet upon the steps. At ground level, the great pyramid of Meereen was a hush place, full of dust and shadows. Its outer walls were 30 feet thick. Within them, sounds echoed off the arches of many-coloured bricks and amongst the stables, stalls, and storerooms. They passed beneath 3 massive arches, down a torch-lit ramp into the vaults beneath the pyramid, past cisterns, dungeons, and torture chambers where slaves had been scourged and skinned and burned with red-hot irons. Finally, they came to a pair of huge iron doors with rusted hinges, guarded by unsullied. At her command, one produced an iron key. The door opened, hinges shrieking. Daenerys Targaryen stepped into the hot heart of darkness and stopped at the lip of a deep pit. 40 feet below, her dragons raised their heads. 4 eyes burned through the shadows, 2 of molten gold and 2 of bronze. Sir Barristan took her by the arm.
No closer. Do you think they would harm me?
I do not know, Your Grace, but I would sooner not risk your person to learn the answer. When Rhaegal roared, a gout of yellow flame turned darkness into day for half a heartbeat. The fire licked along the walls, and Dany felt the heat upon her face, like the blast from an oven. Across the pit, Viserion's wings unfolded, stirring the stale air. He tried to fly to her, but the chain snapped taut as he rose, and slammed him down onto his belly. Links as big as a man's fist bound his feet to the floor. The iron collar about his neck was fastened to the wall behind him. Rhaegal wore matching chains. In the light of Selmy's lantern, his scales gleamed like jade. Smoke rose from between his teeth. Bones were scattered on the floor at his feet, cracked and scorched and splintered. The air was uncomfortably hot, and smelled of sulphur and charred meat.
They are larger,
Danny's voice echoed over the scorched stone walls. A drop of sweat trickled down her brow and fell onto her breast.
Is it true that dragons never stop growing?
If they have food enough and space to grow, chained up in here, though. The great masters had used the pit as a prison. It was large enough to hold 500 men, and more than ample for 2 dragons.
For how long, though? What will happen when they grow too large for the pit? Will they turn on one another with flame and claw? Will they grow wan and weak, with withered flanks and shrunken wings? Will their fires go out before they end?
What sort of mother lets her children rot in darkness?
If I look back
I am doomed, Danny told herself. But how could she not look back?
I should have seen it coming. Was I so blind? Or did I close my eyes willfully so I would not have to see the price of power?
Viserys had told her all the tales when she was little. He loved to talk of dragons. She knew how Harrenhal had fallen. She knew about the Field of Fire and the Dance of the Dragons. One of her forebears, the third Aegon, had seen his own mother devoured by his uncle's dragon. And there were songs beyond count of villages and kingdoms that lived in dread of dragons till some brave dragonslayer rescued them. At Astapor the slaver's eyes had melted. On the road to Yunkai, when Dario tossed the heads of Selar the Bold and Prendal Nar Gazin at her feet, her children made a feast of them. Dragons had no fear of men, and a dragon large enough to gorge on sheep could take a child just as easily. Her name had been Hazea. She was 4 years old, unless her father lied.
He might have lied.
No one had seen the dragon but him. His proof was burnt bones, but burnt bones proved nothing. He might have killed the little girl himself and burnt her afterward. He would not have been the first father to dispose of an unwanted girl child, the shave-pate claimed.
The sons of the Harpy might have done it, and made it look like dragon's work to make the city hate me.
Danny wanted to believe that. But if that were so, why had Hosea's father waited until the audience hall was almost empty to come forward? If his purpose had been to inflame the Meranese against her, he would have told his tale when the hall was full of ears to hear. The shave-pate had urged her to put the man to death.
At least rip out his tongue. This man's lie could destroy us all magnificence.
Instead, Danny chose to pay the blood price. No one could tell her the worth of a daughter, so she set it 100 times the worth of a lamb.
I would give Hazael back to you if I could, she told the father. But some things are beyond the power of even the queen. Her bone shall be laid to rest in the Temple of the Graces, and 100 candles shall burn day and night in her memory. Come back to me each year upon her name day, and your other children shall not want. But this tale must never pass your lips again.
Men will ask, the grieving father had said.
They will ask me where Hosea is, and how she died.
She died of a snake bite,
Mo Resnick insisted.
A ravening wolf carried her off. A sudden sickness took her. Tell him what you will, but never speak of dragons.
The Syrian's claws scrabbled against the stones, and the huge chains rattled as he tried to make his way to her again. When he could not, he gave a roar, twisted his head back as far as he was able, and spat golden flame at the wall behind him.
How soon till his fire burns hot enough to crack stone and melt iron?
Once, not long ago, he had ridden on her shoulder, his tail coiled around her arm. Once she had fed him morsels of charred meat from her own hand. He had been the first chained up. Daenerys had led him to the pit herself and shut him up inside with several oxen. Once he had gorged himself, he grew drowsy. They had chained him whilst he slept. Rhaegal had been harder. Perhaps he could hear his brother raging in the pit, despite the walls of brick and stone between them. In the end, they had to cover him with a net of heavy iron chain as he basked on her terrace, and he fought so fiercely that it had taken 3 days to carry him down the servants' steps, twisting and snapping. 6 men had been burned in the struggle. And Drogon? The Winged Shadow, the grieving father called him. He was the largest of her three, the fiercest, the wildest, with scales as black as night and eyes like pits of fire. Drogon hunted far afield, but when he was sated, he liked to bask in the sun at the apex of the Great Pyramid, where once the Harpy of Meereen had stood. Thrice they had tried to take him there, and thrice they had failed. 20 of her bravest had risked themselves trying to capture him. Almost all had suffered burns, and four of them had died. The last she had seen of Drogon had been at sunset, on the night of the third attempt. The black dragon had been flying north, across the Skahazadan towards the tall grasses of the Dothraki Sea. He had not returned.
Mother of dragons, Daenerys thought, mother of monsters, what have I unleashed upon the world? A queen I am, but my throne is made of burned bones, and it rests on quicksand.
Without dragons, how could she hope to hold Meereen, much less win back Westeros?
I am the blood of the dragon, she thought. If they are monstrous, so am I.
Jaime was the first to spy the inn. The main building hugged the south shore where the river bent, its long low wings outstretched along the water as if to embrace travellers sailing downstream. The lower story was grey stone, the upper whitewashed wood, the roof slate. He could see stables as well, and an arbour heavy with vines. No smoke from the chimneys, he pointed out as they approached, nor lights in the windows. The inn was still open when last I passed this way, said Sir Cleos Frey. They brewed a fine ale. Perhaps there's still some to be had in the cellars.
There may be people, Brian said, hiding or dead.
Frightened of a few corpses, wench, Jamie said. She glared at him.
My name is Brian, yes.
Wouldn't you like to sleep in a bed for a night, Brian? We'd be safer than on the open river, and it might be prudent to find what's happened here.
She gave no answer, but after a moment she pushed at the tiller to angle the skiff in toward the weathered wooden dock. Sir Cleos scrambled to take down the sail. When they bumped softly against the pier, he climbed out to tie them up. Jamie clambered after him, made awkward by his chains. At the end of the dock, a flaking shingle swung from an iron post, painted with the likeness of a king upon his knees, his hands pressed together in a gesture of fealty. Jamie took one look and laughed aloud.
We could not have found a better inn. Is this some special place?
The wench asked suspiciously. Sir Cleos answered,
This is the inn of the Kneeling Man, my lady. It stands upon the very spot where the last king in the north knelt before Aegon the Conqueror to offer his submission. That's him on the sign, I suppose.
Torren had brought his power south after the fall of the two kings on the Field of Fire, said Jamie. But when he saw Aegon's dragon and the size of his host, he chose a path of wisdom and bent his frozen knees. He stopped at the sound of a horse's whinny.
Horses in the stable, one at least. And one is all I need to put the wench behind me. Let's see us home, shall we?
Without waiting for an answer, Jamie went clinking down the dock, put a shoulder to the door, shoved it open, and found himself eye to eye with a loaded crossbow. Standing behind it was a chunky boy of 15.
Lion, fish, or wolf?
The lad demanded. We were hoping for capon. Jamie heard his companions entering behind him. The crossbow is a coward's weapon.
It'll put a bolt through your heart all the same.
Perhaps, but before you can wind it again, my cousin here will spill your entrails on the floor.
Don't be scaring the lad now, Sir Cleos said. We mean no harm, the wench said, and we have coin to pay for food and drink.
She dug a silver piece from her pouch. The boy looked suspiciously at the coin and then at Jamie's manacles.
Why is this one in irons?
Killed some crossbowman, said Jamie.
Do you have ale?
Yes, the boy lowered the crossbow an inch. Undo your sword belts and let them fall, and might be we'll feed you.
He edged around to peer through the thick, diamond-shaped window panes and see if any more of them were outside.
That's a tully sail. We come from River Run,
Brian undid the clasp on her belt and let it clatter to the floor. Sir Cleos followed suit.
A sallow man with a pucked, doughy face stepped through the cellar door, holding a butcher's heavy cleaver.
"See, aye? We got horse meat enough for three. The horse was old and duff, but the meat's still fresh."
"Is there bread?" asked Brian.
"Hard bread and stale oat cakes."
Jamie grinned. "Now, there's an honest innkeep. They all serve you stale bread and stringy meat, but most don't own up to it so freely."
"I'm no innkeep. I buried him out back with his women."
Did you kill them?"
"Would I tell you if I did?"
The man spat.
"Likely it were wolves' work, or maybe lions. What's the difference? The wife and I found them dead. The way we see it, this place is ours now."
"Where is this wife of yours?" Sir Cleos asked. The man gave him a suspicious squint.
"And why will you be wanting to know that? She's not here. No more than you three will be, unless I like the taste of your silver."
Brian tossed the coin to him. He caught it in the air, bit it, and tucked it away.
"She's got more," the boy with a crossbow announced. "So she does, boy. Go down and find me some onions."
The lad raised the crossbow to his shoulder, gave them one last sullen look, and vanished into the cellar.
"Your son?" Sir Cleos asked.
"Just a boy the wife and me took in. We had two sons, but the lions killed one, and the other died of the flux. The boy lost his mother to the bloody mummers. These days a man needs someone to keep watch while he sleeps."
He waved the cleaver at the tables.
"Might as well sit."
The hearth was cold, but Jamie picked the chair nearest the ashes and stretched out his long legs under the table. The clink of his chains accompanied his every movement. "An irritating sound. Before this is done, I'll wrap these chains around that wench's throat. See how she likes them then." The man, who wasn't an innkeep, charred three huge horse steaks and fried the onions in bacon grease, which almost made up for the stale oatcakes. Jamie and Cleos drank ale, Brian a cup of cider. The boy kept his distance, perching atop the cider barrel with his crossbow across his knees, cocked and loaded. The cook drew a tankard of ale and sat with them.
"What news from River Run?"
he asked Sir Cleos, taking him for their leader. Sir Cleos glanced at Brian before answering.
"Lord Hoster is failing, but his son holds the fords of the Red Fork against the Lannisters. There have been battles."
"Battles everywhere. Where are you bound, sir?"
"King's Landing."
Sir Cleos wiped grease off his lips. Their host snorted.
"Then you're three fools. Last I heard, King Stannis was outside the city walls. They say he has 100,000 men and a magic sword."
Jamie's hands wrapped around the chain that bound his wrists, and he twisted it taut, wishing for the strength to snap it in two.
"Then I'd show Stannis where to sheathe his magic sword."
"I'd stay well clear of Black King's Road if I were you,"
the man went on.
"It's worse than bad, I hear. Wolves and lions both, and bands of broken men preying on anyone they can catch."
"Vermin," declared Sir Cleos with contempt. "Such would never dare to trouble armed men."
"Begging your pardon, sir, but I see one armed man travelling with a woman and a prisoner in chains."
Brian gave the cook a dark look.
"The wench does hate being reminded that she's a wench,"
Jamie reflected, twisting at the chains again. The links were cold and hard against his flesh, the iron implacable. The manacles had chafed his wrists raw.
"I mean to follow the trident to the sea," the wench told their host. "We'll find mounts at Maidenpool and ride by way of Duskendale and Rusby. That should keep us well away from the worst of the fighting."
Their host shook his head.
You'll never reach Maidenpool by river. Not 30 miles from here, a couple of boats burned and sank, and the channel's been silting up around them. There's a nest of outlaws there, preying on anyone tries to come by, and more of the same downriver, around the Skipping Stones and Red Deer Island. And the Lightning Lord's been seen in these parts as well. He crosses the river wherever he likes, riding this way and that way, never still.
And who is this Lightning Lord? Demanded Sir Cleos Frey.
Lord Beret, as it please you, sir. They call him that, cos he strikes so sudden, like lightning from a clear sky. It's said he cannot die.
They all die when you shove a sword through them, Jamie thought. Does Thoros of Myr still ride with him?
Aye, the Red Wizard. I've heard tell he has strange powers.
Well, he had the power to match Robert Baratheon drink for drink, and there were few enough who could say that. Jamie had once heard Thoros tell the king that he became a red priest because the robes hid the wine stain so well. Robert had laughed so hard he'd spit ale all over Cersei's silken mantle. "Far be it from me to make objection," he said, "but perhaps the trident is not our safest course."
"I'd say that's so,"
the cook agreed.
"Even if you get past Red Deer Island and don't meet up with Lord Beric and the Red Wizard, there's still the Ruby Ford before you. Last I heard, it was the Leech Lord's wolves held the ford, but that was some time past. By now, it could be lions again, or Lord Beric, or anyone."
"Or no one," Brian suggested.
"If my lady cares to wager a skin on that, I won't stop her. But if I was you, I'd leave this here river, cut overland. If you stay off the main roads and shelter under the trees of a night, hidden, as it were, well, I still wouldn't want to go with you. But you might stand a mummer's chance."
The big wench was looking doubtful. "We would need horses." "There are horses here," Jamie pointed out. "I heard one in the stable."
"Aye, there are,"
said the innkeep, who wasn't an innkeep.
"Three of them, as it happens, but they're not for sale."
Jamie had to laugh. "Of course not, but you'll show them to us anyway." Brian scowled, but the man who wasn't an innkeep met her eyes without blinking, and after a moment, reluctantly, she said, "Show me," and they all rose from the table. The stables had not been mucked out in a long time from the smell of them. Hundreds of fat black flies swarmed amongst the straw, buzzing from stall to stall and crawling over the mounds of horse dung that lay everywhere. But there were only the three horses to be seen. They made an unlikely trio: a lumbering brown plough horse, an ancient white gelding blind in one eye, and a knight's palfrey, dapple grey and spirited.
"They're not for sale at any price,"
their alleged owner announced. "How did you come by these horses?" Brian wanted to know.
"The dray was stabled there when the wife and me come on the inn,"
the man said.
"Along with the one you just ate, the gelding come wandering up one night, and the boy caught the palfrey running free, still saddled and bridled. Here, I'll show you."
The saddle, he showed them, was decorated with silver inlay. The saddle cloth had originally been checkered pink and black, but now it was mostly brown. Jamie did not recognize the original colors, but he recognized bloodstains easily enough. "Well, her owner won't be coming to claim her any time soon." He examined the palfrey's legs, counted the gelding's teeth. "Give him a gold piece for the grey, if he'll include the saddle," he advised Brian. "A silver for the plough horse. He ought to pay us for taking the white off his hands." "Don't speak discourteously of your horse, sir,"
The wench opened the purse Lady Catelyn had given her and took out 3 golden coins.
"I will pay you a dragon for each."
He blinked and reached for the gold, then hesitated and drew his hand back.
"Oh, I don't know. I can't ride no golden dragon if I need to get away, nor eat one if I'm hungry."
"You can have our skiff as well," she said. "Sail up the river or down as you like."
"Let me have a taste of that gold."
The man took one of the coins from her palm and bit it.
"Real enough, I'd say. 3 dragons and the skiff."
"He's rubbing you blind, wench," Jamie said amiably.
"I want provisions too," Brian told their host, ignoring Jamie. "Whatever you have that you can spare."
"There's more oatcakes."
The man scooped the other 2 dragons from her palm and jingled them in his fist, smiling at the sound they made.
"Aye, and smoked salt fish. That will cost you silver. My beds will be costing as well. You'll be wanting to stay the night."
"No," Brian said at once. The man frowned at her.
"Woman, you don't want to go riding at night through strange country on horses you don't know. You like to blunder into some bug or break your horse's leg."
"The moon will be bright tonight," Brian said. "We'll have no trouble finding our way."
Their host chewed on that.
"If you don't have the silver, might be some coppers would buy you them beds, and a coverlet or 2 to keep you warm. It's not like I'm turning travellers away, if you get my meaning."
"That sounds more than fair," said Sir Cleos.
"The coverlet is fresh washed, too. My wife sorted that before she had to go off. Not a flea to be found, neither. You have my word on that."
He jingled the coins again, smiling. Sir Cleos was plainly tempted.
"A proper bed would do us all good, my lady," he said to Brian. We'd make better time on the morrow, once refreshed."
He looked to his cousin for support. "No, cuz, the wench is right. We have promises to keep and long leagues before us. We ought to ride on."
"But," said Cleos, "you said yourself."
"Then, when I thought the inn deserted. Now I have a full belly, and a moonlight ride will be just the thing." He smiled for the wench. "But unless you mean to throw me over the back of that plough horse like a sack of flour, someone had best do something about these irons. It's difficult to ride with your ankles chained together." Brian frowned at the chain. The man, who wasn't an innkeep, rubbed his jaw.
"There's a smithy round back of the stable."
"Show me,"
Brian said. "Yes," said Jamie, "and the sooner the better. There's far too much horse shit about here for my taste. I would hate to step in it." He gave the wench a sharp look, wondering if she was bright enough to take his meaning. He hoped she might strike the irons off his wrist as well, but Brian was still suspicious. She split the ankle chain in the centre with a 6 sharp blows from the smith's hammer delivered to the blunt end of a steel chisel. When he suggested that she break the wrist chain as well, she ignored him.
6 miles downriver, you'll see a burned village,"
their host said, as he was helping them saddle the horses and load their packs. This time he directed his counsel at Brian.
"The road splits there. If you turn south, you'll come to Sir Warren's stone tower house. Sir Warren went off and died, so I couldn't see who holds it now, but it's a place best shunned. You'd do better to follow the track through the woods south by east."
"Ah, we shall," she answered. "You have my thanks."
"More to the point, he has your gold," Jamie kept the thought to himself. He was tired of being disregarded by this huge, ugly cow of a woman. She took the plough horse for herself and assigned the palfrey to Sir Cleos. As threatened, Jamie drew the one-eyed gelding, which put an end to any thoughts he might have had of giving his horse a kick and leaving the wench in his dust. The man and the boy came out to watch them leave. The man wished them luck and told them to come back in better times, while the lad stood silent, his crossbow under his arm. "Take up the spear or maul," Jamie told him. "They'll serve you better." The boy stared at him distrustfully. "So much for friendly advice." He shrugged, turned his horse, and never looked back. Sir Cleus was all complaints as they rode out, still in mourning for his lost featherbed. They rode east along the bank of the moonlit river. The Red Fork was very broad here, but shallow, its banks all mud and reeds. Jamie's mount plodded along placidly, though the poor old thing had a tendency to want to drift off to the side of his good eye. It felt good to be mounted once more. He had not been on a horse since Rob Stark's archers had killed his destrier under him in the Whispering Wood. When they reached the Burn village, a choice of equally unpromising roads confronted them. Narrow tracks, deep rutted by the carts of farmers hauling their grain to the river. One wandered off towards the southeast and soon vanished amidst trees they could see in the distance, while the other, straighter and stonier, arrowed due south. Brian considered them briefly, and then swung her horse onto the southern road. Jamie was pleasantly surprised. It was the same choice he would have made. "But this is the road the innkeep warned us against," Sir Cleus objected.
"He was no innkeep."
She hunched gracelessly in the saddle, but seemed to have a sure seat nonetheless.
"The man took too great an interest in our choice of route. And those woods, such places, are notorious haunts of outlaws. He may have been urging us into a trap."
"Clever wench," Jamie smiled at his cousin. "Our host has friends down that road, I would venture, the ones whose mounts gave that stable such a memorable aroma."
"He may have been lying about the river as well, to put us on these horses," the wench said. "But he could not take the risk. There will be soldiers at the Ruby Ford and the crossroads."
"Well, she may be ugly, but she's not entirely stupid."
Jamie gave her a grudging smile. The ruddy light from the upper windows of the stone tower house gave them warning of its presence a long way off, and Brian led them off into the fields. Only when the stronghold was well to the rear did they angle back and find the road again. Half the night passed before the wench allowed that it might be safe to stop. By then all three of them were drooping in their saddles. They sheltered in a small grove of oak and ash beside a sluggish stream. The wench would allow no fire, so they shared a midnight supper of stale oatcakes and salt fish. The night was strangely peaceful. The half-moon sat overhead in a black felt sky surrounded by stars. Off in the distance, some wolves were howling. One of their horses whickered nervously. There was no other sound. "The war has not touched this place," Jamie thought. He was glad to be here, glad to be alive, glad to be on his way back to Cersei.
"I'll take the first watch," Brian told Sir Cleus, and Frey was soon snoring softly.
Jamie sat against the bole of an oak and wondered what Cersei and Tyrion were doing just now. "Do you have any siblings, my lady?" he asked. Brian squinted at him suspiciously.
"No, I was my father's only child,"
Jamie chuckled.
"Son, you meant to say. Does he think of you as a son? You make a queer sort of daughter, to be sure."
Wordless, she turned away from him, her knuckles tight on her sword hilt.
"What a wretched creature this one is."
She reminded him of Tyrion in some queer way, though at first blush two people could scarcely be more dissimilar. Perhaps it was that thought of his brother that made him say, "I did not intend to give offence, Brian. Forgive me."
"Your crimes are past forgiving, Kingslayer."
"That name again." Jamie twisted idly at his chains.
"Why do I enrage you so?"
I've never done you harm, that I know of. You've harmed others, those you were sworn to protect, the weak, the innocent. The king?
It always came back to Ares. Don't presume to judge what you do not understand, wench.
My name is Brian, yes. Has anyone ever told you you're as tedious as you are ugly? You will not provoke me to anger, Kingslayer.
Oh, I might, if I cared enough to try.
Why did you take the oath? She demanded. Why don the white cloak, if you meant to betray all it stood for?
Why? What could he say that she might possibly understand?
I was a boy, 15. It was a great honor for one so young.
That is no answer, she said scornfully.
You would not like the truth.
He had joined the king's guard for love, of course. Their father had summoned Circe to court when she was 12, hoping to make her a royal marriage. He refused every offer for her hand, preferring to keep her with him in the Tower of the Hand while she grew older and more womanly and ever more beautiful. No doubt he was waiting for Prince Viserys to mature, or perhaps for Rhaegar's wife to die in childbed. Elia of Dawn was never the healthiest of women. Jaime, meantime, had spent 4 years as squire to Sir Sumner Crakehall, and earned his spurs against the Kingswood Brotherhood. But when he made a brief call at King's Landing on his way back to Casterly Rock, chiefly to see his sister, Cersei took him aside and whispered that Lord Tywin meant to marry him to Lysa Tully, had gone so far as to invite Lord Huster to the city to discuss dower. But if Jaime took the white, he could be near her always. Old Sir Harlan Grandison had died in his sleep, as was only appropriate for one whose sigil was a sleeping lion. Ares would want a young man to take his place, so why not a roaring lion in place of a sleepy one? Father will never consent, Jaime objected. The king won't ask him.
And once it's done, father can't object, not openly. Ares had Sir Ilion Payne's tongue torn out just for boasting that it was the Hand who truly ruled the Seven Kingdoms. The captain of the Hand's guard, and yet father dare not try and stop it. He won't stop this either.
But, Jaime said, there's Casterly Rock.
Is it a rock you want, or me?
He remembered that night as if it were yesterday. They spent it in an old inn in Eel Alley, well away from watchful eyes. Cersei had come to him dressed as a simple serving wench, which somehow excited him all the more. Jaime had never seen her more passionate. Every time he went to sleep, she woke him again. By morning, Casterly Rock seemed a small price to pay to be near her always. He gave his consent, and Cersei promised to do the rest. A moon's turn later, a royal raven arrived at Casterly Rock to inform him that he had been chosen for the king's guard. He was commanded to present himself to the king during the great tourney at Harrenhal to say his vows and don his cloak. Jaime's investiture freed him from Lysa Tully. Elsewise, nothing went as planned. His father had never been more furious. He could not object openly. Cersei had judged that correctly. But he resigned the handship on some thin pretext and returned to Casterly Rock, taking his daughter with him. Instead of being together, Cersei and Jaime just changed places, and he found himself alone at court, guarding a mad king, while 4 lesser men took their turns dancing on knives in his father's ill-fitting shoes. So swiftly did the hands rise and fall that Jaime remembered their heraldry better than their faces. The Horn of Plenty hand and the Dancing Griffin's hand had both been exiled. The Mason Dagger hand dipped in wildfire and burned alive. Lord Rossart had been the last. His sigil had been a burning torch, an unfortunate choice, given the fate of his predecessor,
but the alchemist had been elevated largely because he shared the king's passion for fire. I ought to have drowned Rossart instead of gutting him. Brian was still awaiting his answer. Jamie said, "You are not old enough to have known Aerys Targaryen." She would not hear it.
"Aerys was mad and cruel. No one has ever denied that. He was still king, crowned and anointed, and you had sworn to protect him."
"I know what I swore."
"And what you did."
She loomed above him, 6 feet of freckled, frowning, horse-toothed disapproval. "Yes, and what you did as well. We're both kingslayers here, if what I've heard is true."
"I never harmed Renly. I'll kill the man who says I did."
"Best start with Cleos, then. And you'll have a deal of killing to do after that, the way he tells the tale."
"Lies! Lady Catelyn was there when his grace was murdered. She saw. There was a shadow. The candles guttered, and the air grew cold, and there was blood."
"Very good," Jamie laughed. "Your wits are quicker than mine, I confess it. When they found me standing over my dead king, I never thought to say, 'No, no, it wasn't me, it was a shadow, a terrible cold shadow.'" He laughed again. "Tell me true, one kingslayer to another, did the Starks pay you to slit his throat, or was it Stannis? Had Renly spurned you? Was that the way of it? Or perhaps your moon's blood was on you? Never give a wench a sword when she's bleeding." For a moment, Jamie thought Brienne might strike him. "A step closer, and I'll snatch that dagger from her sheath and bury it up her womb." He gathered a leg under him, ready to spring, but the wench did not move.
"It is a rare and precious gift to be a knight," she said, "and even more so a knight of the King's Guard. It is a gift given to few, a gift you scorned and soiled."
"A gift you want desperately, wench, and can never have." "I earned my knighthood. Nothing was given to me. I won a tourney melee at 13, when I was yet a squire. At 15, I rode with Sir Arthur Dane against the Kingswood Brotherhood, and he knighted me on the battlefield. It was that white cloak that soiled me, not the other way around. So spare me your envy. It was the gods who neglected to give you a cock, not me." The look Brian gave him was full of loathing. "She would gladly hack me to pieces, but for her precious vow," he reflected. "Good. I've had enough of feeble pieties and maiden's judgments." The wench stalked off without saying a word. Jamie curled up beneath his cloak, hoping to dream of Cersei. But when he closed his eyes, it was Aerys Targaryen he saw, pacing alone in his throne room, picking at his scabbed and bleeding hands. The fool was always cutting himself on the blades and barbs of the Iron Throne. Jaime had slipped in through the king's door, clad in his golden armour, sword in hand. The golden armour, not the white. But no one ever remembers that. Would that I had taken off that damn cloak as well. When Aerys saw the blood in his blade, he demanded to know if it was Lord Tywin's.
"I want him dead, the traitor. I want his head. You'll bring me his head, or you'll burn with all the rest. All the traitors, Rossart says, they are inside the walls. He's gone to make them a warm welcome. Whose blood? Whose?"
"Rossart's," answered Jamie. Those purple eyes grew huge then, and the royal mouth drooped open in shock. He lost control of his bowels, turned, and ran for the Iron Throne. Beneath the empty eyes of the skulls on the walls, Jaime hauled the last Dragon King bodily off the steps, squealing like a pig and smelling like a privy. A single slash across his throat was all it took to end it. "So easy," he remembered thinking. "A king should die harder than this." Rossart at least tried to make a fight of it, though, if truth be told, he fought like an alchemist. Queer they never ask who killed Rossart, but of course he was no one,
low-born, hand for a fortnight, just another mad fancy of the Mad King. Sir Ellis Westling and Lord Crakehall and others of his father's knights burst into the hall in time to see the last of it, so there was no way for Jamie to vanish and let some braggart steal the praise or blame. It would be blame, he knew at once when he saw the way they looked at him, though perhaps that was fear. Lannister or no, he was one of Aerys Seven.
"The castle is ours, sir, and the city," Roland Crakehall told him, which was half true.
Tregarian loyalists were still dying on the Serpentine Steps and in the armory. Gregor Clegane and Aemry Lorch were scaling the walls of Maegar's Holdfast, and Ned Stark was leading his Northmen through the King's Gate even then. But Crakehall could not have known that. He had not seemed surprised to find Aerys slain. Jaime had been Lord Tywin's son long before he had been named to the King's Guard. "Tell them the Mad King is dead," he commanded. "Spare all those who yield, and hold them captive."
"Shall I proclaim a new king as well?" Crakehall asked,
and Jaime read the question plain. "Shall it be your father, or Robert Baratheon, or do you mean to try to make a new Dragon King?" He thought for a moment of the boy Viserys, fled to Dragonstone, and of Rhaegar's infant son, Aegon, still in Maegor's with his mother. "A new Targaryen king, and my father's hand. How the wolves will howl, and the Stormlords choke with rage." For a moment he was tempted, until he glanced down again at the body on the floor, in its spreading pool of blood. His blood is in both of them, he thought.
"Proclaim who you bloody will like," he told Crakehall.
Then he climbed the Iron Throne and seated himself with his sword across his knees to see who would come to claim the kingdom. As it happened, it had been Eddard Stark. "You had no right to judge me either, Stark." In his dreams, the dead came burning, gowned in swirling green flames. Jaime danced around them with a golden sword, but for every one he struck down, two more arose to take his place. Brienne woke him with a boot in the ribs. The world was still black, and it had begun to rain. They broke their fast on oat cakes, salt fish, and some blackberries that Sir Cleos had found, and were back in the saddle before the sun came up.
The Kraken's Daughter. The hall was loud with drunken harlaws, distant cousins all. Each lord had hung his banner behind the benches where his men were seated. "Too few," thought Asher Greyjoy, looking down from the gallery. "Too few by far." The benches were three-quarters empty. Carl the Maid had said as much when the black wind was approaching from the sea. He had counted the longships moored beneath her uncle's castle, and his mouth had tightened. "They have not come," he observed, "or not enough of them." He was not wrong, but Asher could not agree with him, out where her crew might hear. She did not doubt their devotion, but even ironborn will hesitate to give their lives for a cause that's plainly lost. "Do I have so few friends as this?" Amongst the banners, she saw the silver fish of Botley, the stone tree of the stone trees, the black leviathan of Volmark, the nooses of the mirrors. The rest were Harlaw scythes. Bodamond placed his upon a pale blue field. Hotho's was girdled within an embattled border, and the knight had quartered his with the gaudy peacock of his mother's house. Even Siegfried Silverhair showed two scythes counterchanged on a field divided bendwise. Only the Lord Harlaw displayed the silver scythe plain upon a night-black field, as it had flown in the dawn of days. Roderick called the Reader, Lord of the Ten Towers, Lord of Harlaw, Harlaw of Harlaw, her favourite uncle. Lord Roderick's high seat was vacant. Two scythes of beaten silver crossed above it, so huge that even a giant would have difficulty wielding them. But beneath were only empty cushions. Asha was not surprised. The feast was long concluded. Only bones and greasy platters remained upon the trestle tables. The rest was drinking, and her uncle Roderick had never been partial to the company of quarrelsome drunks. She turned to Three-Tooth, an old woman of fearful age who had been her uncle's steward since she was known as Twelve-Tooth. "My uncle is with his books."
"Aye, where else?"
The woman was so old that a septon had once said she must have nursed the crone. That was when the faith was still tolerated on the Isles. Lord Roderick had kept septons at Ten Towers not for his soul's sake, but for his books.
"With the books, and Botley. He was with him too."
Botley's standard hung in the hall, a shoal of silver fish upon a pale green field, though Asha had not seen his swift fin amongst the other long ships. "I had heard mine uncle Crowseye had old Sir Wayne Botley drowned."
"Lord Tristopher Botley, this one is."
Triss. She wondered what had happened to Sir Wayne's elder son, Harren. "I will find out soon enough, no doubt. This should be awkward." She had not seen Triss Botley since... No, she ought not dwell on it. "And my lady mother?"
"A bed," said Three-Tooth, "in the widow's tower."
"Aye, where else? The widow the tower was named after was her aunt. Lady Gwyness had come home to mourn after her husband had died off Fair Isle during Balon Greyjoy's first rebellion. "I will only stay until my grief has passed," she had told her brother famously. "Though by rights, Ten Towers should be mine, for I am 7 years your elder." Long years had passed since then, but still the widow lingered, grieving and muttering from time to time that the castle should be hers. And now Lord Roderick has a second half-mad widowed sister beneath his roof. Asha reflected, small wonder if he seeks solace in his books. Even now it was hard to credit that frail, sickly Lady Alanis had outlived her husband Lord Balon, who had seemed so hard and strong. When Asha had sailed away to war, she had done so with a heavy heart, fearing that her mother might well die before she could return. Not once had she thought that her father might perish instead. "The drowned god plays savage japes upon us all, but men are crueler still." A sudden storm and a broken rope had sent Balon Greyjoy to his death, or so they claim. Asha had last seen her mother when she stopped at Ten Towers to take on fresh water on her way north to strike at Deepwood Mott. Alanis Harlaw never had the sort of beauty the singers cherished, but her daughter had loved her fierce, strong face and the laughter in her eyes. On that last visit, though, she had found Lady Alanis in a window seat, huddled beneath a pile of furs, staring out across the sea. "Is this my mother or her ghost?" she remembered thinking as she'd kissed her cheek. Her mother's skin had been parchment thin, her long hair white. Some pride remained in the way she held her head, but her eyes were dim and cloudy and her mouth had trembled when she asked after Theon.
"Did you bring my baby boy?"
she had asked. Theon had been 10 years old when he was carried off to Winterfell, a hostage, and so far as Lady Alanis was concerned, he would always be 10 years old, it seemed.
"Theon could not come,"
Asha had to tell her. "Father sent him reaving along the stony shore." Lady Alanis had naught to say to that. She only nodded slowly, yet it was plain to see how deep her daughter's words had cut her. "And now I must tell her that Theon is dead, and drive yet another dagger through her heart." There were two knives buried there already. On the blades were writ the words Roderick and Maron, and many a time they twisted cruelly in the night. "I will see her on the morrow," Asha vowed to herself. Her journey had been long and wearisome. She could not face her mother now. "I must speak with Lord Roderick," she told Three-Tooth. "See to my crew, once they're done unloading Black Wind. They'll bring captives. I want them to have warm beds and a hot meal."
"There's cold beef in the kitchens and mustard in a big stone jar from Old Town."
The thought of that mustard made the old woman smile. A single long brown tooth poked from her gums. That will not serve. We had a rough crossing. I want something hot in their bellies. Asha hooked a thumb through the studded belt about